Hey, Intelligence Squared listeners. Producer Faye Adebita here. I just wanted to let you know about our first Intelligence Squared collection, Black History and Culture. We're revisiting some of our favourite live events and podcasts from the past 20 years, showcasing great creators and thinkers, including the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, Alicia Garza, poet and activist, Benjamin Zephaniah, and playwright, novelist, critic and broadcaster, Bonnie Greer. We also delve into debates such as, should the West pay reparations for slavery, and hip-hop versus Shakespeare. Just search Intelligence Squared, Black History and Culture, wherever you get your podcasts.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Hello, podcast listeners. It's Connor from Intelligence Squared. We hope you've been enjoying the wide range of topics we've been covering on the podcast lately. And of course, we hope you like today's episode. It features Helen Pluckrose, who is the co-author of a new book called Cynical Theories. It looks to delve into the ideological roots of quote unquote wokeness, looking at what ideological forces are driving much of the conversation around gender, race, and identity today. It's a really fascinating conversation, and she spoke to Helen Joyce, who is a writer formerly of The Economist and who is also writing her own book on gender-based ideology. And we hope you enjoy the episode.
Hello, and welcome to this Intelligence Squared podcast with me, Helen Joyce. I'm delighted to introduce our guest today, Helen Pluckrose. She's the editor of Aero magazine and co-author with James Lindsay of a new book, Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender and Identity and Why This Harms Everybody. It's out now.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's very exciting to have you on. I really enjoyed the book. I actually bookmarked it as soon as I heard about it several months ago because I thought that's a book I need to read.
Oh, thank you. I'm never quite sure. People always seem to have an opinion very far in one direction or the other.
Well, that's the world we live in, and actually that's something we're probably going to talk about, isn't it? I wanted to start with that word cynical. I have the book on my phone. I don't have a print copy or I'd show our audience, but you've got the word critical and you've the word cynical written over it. So it's like critical theories, but cynical theories instead. Cynical. What's cynical?
Okay, so when postmodernism arose, it was defined as a scepticism towards meta-narratives. And what annoys us is that this particular approach, this critical approach, considers itself to be the epitome of scepticism, whereas in fact being skeptical of meta-narratives has been something that had been happening throughout the modern period. This is what the whole sort of scientific revolution was about. How do I know this is true? So we say that the theories that came out of these postmodern ideas aren't skeptical, because skeptical is doubtful and it's still in search of some kind of truth. It's cynical because it begins with the assumption that everything is about power imbalances and people trying to protect their power, and then it reads society through it.
So no idea about how people are working in, you know, together, or sometimes in opposition sometimes, but towards some variety of truth or objectivity or understanding or any of those things.
Yeah, exactly. I think Alan Sokol and Jean Bricmont, they wrote it very well. They said there's a specific scepticism in which we say, how do we know this is true? And then we work out how to find out if it is true, how to falsify it if it isn't true. And this is interesting and productive. If you've got the kind of radical scepticism of the postmodern approach, you don't even look for truth. You just start with this idea that we can't actually obtain truth. And what's interesting is what power dynamics are in play here.
So you've said the word power several times here, and I do want to come back to that, but I want to say just one more thing, or get you to comment on one more thing before we do that. So you've said now twice, I think, meta-narrative. So they're sceptical about meta-narratives, but it sounds like what you're saying is there is a meta-narrative. They have their own.
Yes, this is the third generation. So in the 60s, Jean-François Lyotard, he described postmodernism as a scepticism towards meta-narratives, and that's all those big overarching explanations for things. So Christianity, obviously, Marxism, but science and progress as well. So he was sceptical of that, and so were all of the first postmodernists. They really took things apart. They didn't really try to build anything. But as these few core ideas about power, knowledge and language have evolved over the last 50 years, they have formed a meta-narrative of their own now.
So power, knowledge and language. And from reading your book, power is what people have kind of innately because of their characteristics, and language is what brings the whole thing together by how we talk about it in our discourses, and knowledge is what we're creating by discoursing, if that's a verb. Is that about right?
Yes. So it's Michel Foucault particularly who joined the words power and knowledge to make one, power knowledge. And this is what underlies everything. So it isn't that people are deliberately trying to exercise power over others necessarily. It's that people are born into certain positions in society that gives them a certain relationship to power. The powerful forces get to decide what is knowledge and what isn't. And then this is legitimised and everybody speaks through these discourses of knowledge, which are really discourses of power. So they can be called things like white supremacy, patriarchy, cisnormativity, heteronormativity, and we're all upholding them all the time by assuming that there is knowledge that is legitimate about these things.
So we've been quite abstract up till now. We've talked about things like meta-narratives and discourses, and now you've started to hint at some rather specific versions of this. So in the book, you give a chapter each to several of these cynical theories. So, you know, critical race theory, etc., etc. Let's pick race, since you mentioned the white fragility or the white supremacy sort of idea. That's very topical right now, and we have books like, with people like Robin DiAngelo talking about white fragility and so on. What's wrong with that? I mean, We do live in a world where, you know, people have been horribly oppressed on the basis of race. There is a hierarchy here. So are they getting it completely wrong? Have they got some aspect of it right?
They're getting the approach wrong. So if we're going to look at racism, there are a number of different ways to do this. So the liberal approach to racism, which was the kind put forward by Martin Luther King, for example, this aims to take significance out of identity categories. So, you know, while being black or being a woman could be important to your sense of who you are, it shouldn't tell society anything about your moral or social value or what role you should play in the world. So this is what the liberal approach is. When critical race theory arose, it took aim at that particularly. It didn't agree with the liberal approach of trying to be colourblind. It obviously, it tends to interpret that as a willingness to be blind to racism, which isn't at all the same thing. If you think being colourblind is a positive thing that we should aim for in a society, it means you oppose people who are not being colourblind, people who are being racist. So when we look at racism, we need the most rigorous scholarship that's out there. And there are some very, very rigorous scholars out there. They take a materialist empirical approach. So you could look at the research into the criminal justice system by someone like Michelle Alexander, for example, and you will find her looking at systems, at laws, at numbers, and she'll be analysing this in a strong and steady way. But if you go with somebody like Robin DiAngelo, she is all about theory, her own interpretation of how all white people must think, how all black people must experience things. She wants all white people to admit that they have been socialised into believing that black people are inferior in various ways, and then work to dismantle that, even though that isn't actually ever possible. So one of her, when she wrote a number of tenets with a team, and one of them was, the question is not did racism occur, but how did racism manifest in this situation? So it's assumed to always be there.
It reminds me very much of the logic of the ducking stool. You know, you've got the, you know, if the witch sinks, she wasn't a witch, and if she floats, well, we'll burn her. So there's just no way out. There's nothing that you can do in this situation.
No, exactly. DiAngelo, she gives us two choices. You can either be racist and acknowledge it and work against it, or you can be racist and in selfish denial of it.
So it's unfalsifiable, and that's obvious. That's a feature. That's not a bug, I guess, because she doesn't want anybody denying it. How can this actually have caught on when I thought we had, you know, I thought we had actually solidified the idea that what was the power of the modern world was that we had theories that we could test and we could falsify them and we could reject them if they weren't good enough and replace them by new ones. How did that even catch on?
This is what has been being undermined. This is the liberal approach, and it's what Jonathan Rauch calls liberal science, that process where everybody can raise any idea they want. Anybody else can challenge that idea. There's the belief that we can all get at ideas and examine them on their own merits, and that the individual has agency to reject some ideas and uphold others. So this, to the postmodernists, is very, very naive. It's either an extreme naivety and an inability to see the invisible power structures, or it's a selfish attempt to protect one's own privilege. So you see, to some extent, there is, of course, truth in this, because if we look at how our understanding of homosexuality has changed, for example, dominant discourses for a long time said it was a heinous sin. Then it said it was a shameful disorder. Now the dominant discourse around homosexuality is some people are gay, get over it. So this has changed. But whereas the liberals would say this has changed because we were able to look at it, talk about it, discuss it, apply science to it, and, you know, really sort of compare arguments for what homosexuality is. Does it have any moral valence at all? And that was how we overcame prejudice against homosexuality. But the discourse theorists, the descendants of the postmodernists, would say this is naive. And what all that has happened is that the ways of talking about things have changed. We are still living in a very heterocentrist and cis-centrist society, and that those power structures are still there and they still need to be dismantled.
And they think that we're going to do that by changing the way that we talk about things.
Yes, precisely. If language creates social reality, changing language can create a better one.
And if you think that, like, if one thinks that we're in this sort of invisible web, this power web, we're all of us positioned according to our characteristics, we maybe even don't see these things until somebody has taught us the techniques of critical whatever theory. And how can, like, it sounds like we're trying to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps if you believe that you can change the way that you talk and that would change reality. Like, it is incredibly pessimistic, and I don't know how they think, if you think like that, how they think that you can even change your language.
Well, some theorists have argued that it's almost impossible. Christy Dotson, for example, when she does her conceptualizing epistemic oppression, she says that third level, that one where you have to try to even speak in the language that you have, trying to see that there is a problem when you only have the language, the epistemic resources that you have, is almost impossible. So there is a lot of pessimism there, but there's also a certain simplicity to it, and there's a certain appeal to it, because people feel as though we're only at the beginning. They don't know, not even that the most advanced theorists in the world know exactly how this power system works. But what we're doing is we're picking at it, we're digging at it, we're trying to see it, we're uncovering more bits of it. Because it's unfalsifiable, somebody can identify racism within any interaction. And as long as it's according to the theory, it will be deemed authoritative, it will be correct. So there's a lot of room for people to play with these ideas, for them to interpret things, and to them feel like you're really uncovering new ground and setting the scene for improving things.
Right, so they feel like they're making progress because when there's no falsifiability, everything is sort of progress, every bit of thing that you say.
Yeah, and it's beginning to be able to see it. That's the thing. D'Angelo often says we need to make it visible and then we can get at it.
I mean, I think the second bit of that doesn't necessarily follow from the first, but since I don't agree with the first either, I think that's kind of irrelevant. I thought it was very interesting the way you talked. I think it was maybe in an article just very recently, you said this thing about what cancel culture really is. And there was a great explanation that the point of cancel culture is that if people are saying wrong things and those wrong things are creating wrongness, then silencing them is an extremely moral thing to do. and silencing them by any means, really. And you don't have to debate them. Debating them will be bad. Yeah. Have I got that about right?
Yes, exactly. I think this makes intuitive sense to humans. I mean, this is why there have been such strong laws against heresy and blasphemy, because the idea is you can corrupt society, you can taint and damn others. Even with things like the Inquisition, which was such a sort of terrorising thing, there was a moral imperative underneath that. The idea was that if people speak heresy, if they challenge the orthodoxy, the truth of God, this will corrupt and taint the rest of society and cause people to be damned to hell. So there's this incentive to really make to ensure that people are thinking and speaking in the right way for the good of everybody, and that's what you get right now. I mean, the strongest mantra I think that people are expected to repeat at the moment is trans women are women. And so no matter what you actually believe about trans identity, I'm fully in support of trans rights and people identifying as they wish to, with, you know, there's obviously conversations that need to be happen about spaces and sports. But no matter what you think about this, it's difficult to notice that the emphasis is very much on language. Are you saying things which suggest that trans women aren't women? The way to respond to that is not with an argument. So we don't have people arguing back and forwards as much as we have them throwing mantras at each other, as if they're trying to outspeak each other on the level of these discourses. If I say trans women are women often enough, if enough people say it, that will make the social reality be what is needed for the acceptance of trans people.
Yeah, it's interesting because I must say I had sort of thought that anyone who hung on to a mantra that much couldn't possibly really believe it. You know, that if you feel secure in your own ideas, I'd always thought, but then this just shows that I'm from a previous generation, I always thought if you were secure in your ideas, you wouldn't mind debating them. You'd feel confident that you could answer any criticism that people put forward. But I think what you showed, you gave me a different way to conceive of this, was that the very saying of these things was a harm. And I hadn't understood that before, that, you know, I was creating an evil, according to these people, by saying things, even possibly if I was saying them on my own in a room. Mm. You know, I'm not even meant to think them. I'm not even meant to say them in my head, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this is why we get the argument that gender critical feminists are involved in the murder of trans women, even though, you know, trans women do seem to be particularly vulnerable to violence. But this has never been by a gender critical feminist. But there's this idea that they're speaking into a narrative that invalidates, delegitimizes trans people. It creates a hostile environment and one in which it is acceptable for them to be abused by people who have completely different ideas and aren't feminist at all. So it seems
quite remarkable. I mean, I lived in Brazil for several years, and I mean, that is one of the places where trans women are murdered. I mean, you know, it's actually one of the hotspots of it in Rio de Janeiro, because there's a lot of street workers there, you know. Yeah. They're not listening to what gender critical feminists are saying. I mean, these men, it's nothing to do with that. It's, you know, some mixture of violence, homophobia, to be honest, self-hatred, et cetera, you know, and just being violent. Is anyone really so convinced if they think it through, or is the point that they're stopping themselves from thinking it through by saying the mantra? Like, is it a thought-stopping cliche?
I have a tendency to think that it is actually quite normal, quite intuitive to humans to think that our words have more power than they do. I think that the idea that if we can just get everybody saying the right thing, everything will be okay, actually makes a lot of sense to us. We're a storytelling species. So I think what's more counterintuitive to us is the idea that there can be worth in getting people together who have two different views on a thing and getting them to argue their own side using evidence and a reasoned argument. This doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to a lot of the activists right now. And it hasn't made a lot of sense historically. I think people like you and I and our generation and people who have been involved in having these kind of conversations, it seems that this is the obvious way. You know, we talk about things, we exchange ideas. This is how we progress. But it doesn't seem to be that intuitive to a lot of people.
Yes, maybe it was a brief period, but it was a brief and very glorious period.
I think it's something we have to we have to hang on to it. We have to constantly reinforce it. Otherwise, we are likely to lose it, and it will be the most powerful narrative wins.
So let's see. I want to ask you what you think this means for two particular large areas, very important areas of society that I think are really under attack at the moment. And one is academia and the other one is journalism. So academia seems to have pretty much fallen to these ideas, at least large chunks of it.
I think it's certainly very much overpowered by it. Of course, you get, I don't think the majority of academics hold these views. And there, you don't find them in every field. They're really sort of concentrated in a cluster in the humanities and also on campus culture. But anybody who goes against them is likely to find themselves in trouble. So this is what I found when I'm studying late medieval women's religious writing. Now, I can do work that I can be proud of as long as I'm not looking at what sex is, what gender is, how it works in any way that's going to go against the dominant narrative. You know, so if somebody wanted to be a historian and they wanted to look at agriculture or something, they could go through their whole lives without coming cropper with this. But if you're a scientist and you want to look at, say, how sex differences exist between men and women, then you're going to find yourself in trouble.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think that's a bit of it that people don't see if they're outside what we might call a knowledge-producing industry. So I'll count journalism as that, even if it's not very fair. That it's the self-censorship. It's before you even get to the area that's touchy. So it's not about the people who were sacked, it's about the people who never said anything more than anything else.
Yes. I hear it from a lot of academics, and I hear from a lot of people generally who write to me and say, I think I'm the only person in my organisation who is concerned about this. And then quite often now I happen to know that they're not, and I can put them in touch with somebody else. And I think there's a lot more people who are concerned about it, or who at least don't agree with it. I think with a lot of liberals on the left who still actually have those kind of beliefs that I'd like them to have about the value of different ideas and the exchange of debate and consistent principles, they tend to understand the social justice approach is a more friendly and liberal thing than it is, and feel that they should be supportive of it and the scholars producing it, because the problem on the right is a more severe one. If you are a leftist, yes, we're going to worry about the rise of right-wing populists. And they then get rather annoyed with people on the left who are saying, yes, but this is a problem that's on the left. It is a problem. We do need to address it.
And more than that, they're connected, aren't they?
I think so.
Yeah. So you tell me about how you think they're connected then.
I think there are two ways. If you are a leftist and you want left-wing parties to win and be able to institute left-wing policies, there are two things you have to do. You have to show the problem with the party on the right, and you have to make your own party a strong one and one that people can respect. And I don't think that's happening on the left at the moment. I think that there's this division between the identitarians, the radicals and the liberals on the left. And at the moment, the identity politics left is the one that is most visible. It's the one that corporations and politicians feel that they have to appease. And I think it's driving people right. Now, I can't know how many people went right because of this. So it's not very helpful to guess. But I do think that if we could have a more consistently liberal left, then we'd have been a better chance of getting people to vote left again.
So the profession that worries me most, I have to say, because it's the one I'm in, is journalism. And I think you see a lot of the same tendencies, in particular the self-censorship. Not surprisingly, I suppose. I mean, a lot of money has gone out of journalism. A lot of people have gone out of journalism. It's become a low-paid, very temporary and casual sort of work that young people come into, and they have no time, no specialism, no support from older journalists. And of course, they're all graduates now, and most of them have come in from the sorts of courses where they learnt this sort of stuff. So I'm absolutely astounded at how fast this has happened, that journalism has been hollowed out. And I also see this as part of the political problem, because ordinary people slowly get the sense that they're not actually reading what's going on. They're reading a sort of a self-censored version of it in what are meant to be the papers of record. So you have your own magazine, you edit a sort of a new magazine. Is this part of the motivation for you, that you see no other place to put the sorts of things that you want to say?
Yeah, that was why Aereo was created in the first place by Malham Marley. He wanted something that wasn't left-wing or right-wing, but something that would have views from both sides, but would argue them straightforwardly with evidence and reason. And so that is what we try to do. We have quite a lot of leftists who write for us, but few of them are the social justice leftists. They tend to be socialists or social democrats. And we have quite a lot of conservatives as well, and Christians, and they will write from their belief systems. And this, I think, works well. We don't require people to be apolitical, but we do require them to both state what political position they're coming from is, and try to look charitably and concede as much as they can to the one they're criticizing.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
So, okay, I'm going to take a bit of a leap, a sidestep here, and say how fascinating I find it, endlessly fascinating, the way that race in one bucket, and then what we might say sex, gender and sexuality in another bucket, how incredibly differently theorised these two things are. So race, which actually is this fluid, blurred sort of category, you know, I mean, the race line was drawn differently in different countries at different times, etc., is regarded as the most rigid possible thing. And sex, gender, sexuality, when, you know, sex is incredibly rigid, sexuality feels for most people quite binary, not everybody, but most. Gender less so, but I mean, compared with race, you know. How did that happen? How did we end up sort of almost the wrong way round there?
Okay, so I think that we've come from different places. So queer theory, which is where a lot of the sort of gender theory and trans activism comes from, that's the most purely postmodern. So it believes that there is a problem with knowledge, and that it's been constructed in the service of power. So to get at that, we have to look at the categories through which we think, and to try to blur those boundaries, dismantle those categories, and stop putting people into them. They believe that if we get rid of all categories that aren't, you know, feminine women attracted to men or masculine man attracted to women, then the world will become a more welcoming place to the people who don't naturally fit into one of those categories. So we've got that whole fluid thing going on there. And in fact, queer has become a verb. And to queer something is to blur the boundaries and to mix up the categories. So that's one particular theory, and it relies quite a lot on Derrida and Foucault. So when we're going into critical race theory, this comes from a different lineage that has quite a lot of input from the radical new left. And then it has the postmodern influence on top. So Kimberlé Crenshaw, when she described intersectionality, she described it as contemporary politics, by which she meant the radical activism, linked to postmodern theory, by which she meant the idea of everything being culturally constructed. But she wanted some acceptance of objective truth to be there. She criticised the postmodernists, saying that, you know, we can't just dismantle everything. We have to accept that some things are objectively true, or we can't achieve anything. So those systems of power and privilege had to be seen as true. And I think because this comes from America, and because there really has been that rigid line in America, you know, there has been that one drop rule, where if you are black at all, then you are black. And so this, the whole sort of identity politics to push back at this has taken this as well as a solid category. They don't think that race is a biological category. They do think it's a social construct, but they think it's been constructed very simply into white supremacy and black subordination.
How can we get some of the things that are never talked about in this whole worldview that are actually to do with power, in particular money and class? How can we get money and class back into this sort of discussion? Poverty, I never hear it. I never actually hear poverty or poor, except when it's kind of tagged on to other things, you know, poor black women or, you know, I mean, just poverty.
This is why it's been the Marxists who have been criticising the postmodernists for longest. And we still have the traditional Marxists who are still saying you are dividing the working class. This is now all about rich black and white people, usually in universities. We're not looking at economics or class at all now. This is an entirely bourgeois enterprise. And, you know, they're criticising it on these grounds. And so they get quite annoyed when people then call what we're seeing now neo-Marxism. Because this is nothing to do with Marx. You can't blame him for this. But I think that there are more connections with the whole sort of revolutionary idea. But leaving class out is, I think, one of the most serious drawbacks of the critical race approach. Because we can look at race, certainly, and you don't always have to only look at class. I think the Marxists are a bit restricted if they only want to look at class, and particularly in a country in which race has been significant for so long. But by only including class when somebody has another intersecting identity that is marginalised, we're going to lose a lot of the sort of empirical analysis that we could have to actually make things better. I mean, a lot of the reason that black Americans have such a lower outcomes in life generally is surely because they've only been allowed to try to rise out of the lowest positions for about two generations now. We know that the best indicator of an individual's success is if their parents have been successful. So it's not going to happen straight away, and it's not going to happen unless we look at social and material factors as well as potential prejudice.
And it also seems something that is quite obviously going to create pushback. So if you've got I think you mentioned this in the book, you sort of give a hypothetical example of, you know, a very poor white person, like somebody with a really, really hard life. And if the only thing you have to say to that person is, if you'd been black, it would have been even worse. It's like, oh, come on, you know, and if the person saying it is a university graduate of whatever race, this is extremely painful. It sounds like nobody has anything to offer you, and you may as well just go off to the right.
Yes, I think this does make a lot of working class people feel alienated. We've seen the surge to the right from the working class, both here in the UK, although we can't sort of put too much emphasis on that being anything to do with the social justice, because there was the whole Brexit thing going on as well. But yeah, the working class do seem to be going to the right. They see Trump as having their interests more in mind. They see Boris Johnson as having their interests more in mind. Now, this is a really strange development, and I think critical social justice ideas have got to take some responsibility for that.
So something else that you talked about in the book that I thought was really also clarifying for me was that we have three levels of analysis. We could say individual and group and universal. And as a liberal, the emphasis is really on individual and universal. So we are human beings when that's what we share, but also we're individuals, so we have our own interests. Whereas all these sort of cynical theories that you talk about are really at that middle level group. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that, and whether you think liberals could maybe learn something from that, or whether you think that particular way of slicing things through should just be abandoned.
I think it would be great if we didn't have to think in terms of group, but as a tribal territorial species, I think we always will have to. So I think sometimes when the socialists and the social justice scholars have criticised liberalism for focusing too much on the individual having access to everything and our shared humanity and not enough on group, they do make a point, because it's quite simplistic to think, well, we just want every individual to be able to do everything and not look at things that could be holding them back from that, which could be their class, could be their race, could be their sex. So we do need to have that kind of focus. And I think the liberal civil rights movements of the 60s and 70s, liberal feminism, gay pride, the civil rights movements, they were largely driven by this liberal universalist impulse. They said, we want to have the same rights as everybody else, which is very different to the identity politics approach, which is we are this group with this source of power, you are a different group, and we are in conflict.
Right, so you're saying maybe the group is the way that an inequality lawyer or might look at this would be to say, well, you know, this could be indirect discrimination. There could be something here that it's a facially neutral policy, as they say in American law, meaning everybody has access, but actually not really. And that could be discrimination. So you can kind of fit it into a liberal framework. You don't have to go the whole way down to, you know, group thought is all.
I think we need a liberal framework overall, but one that takes input from from class analysis and from identity analysis, because that is how humans work. I think the danger of focusing too much on groups is that brings out the worst of human nature, because we are tribal, because it's so easy for us to think well of our own group, demonize an out group, and we become callously indifferent to people who aren't on our team. That's something we need to always protect against, and we need an element of liberal humanism to do that, to be thinking of as many people as possible as coming within our sphere of concern. So my fear with identity politics is that it will lead, and it is leading, to really harsh conflict and an inability to see each other as human beings or as individuals.
So the first time I heard of intersectionality, I thought that's what it was trying to do, that it was saying, think about the way that this could be different for people who are different. You know, think, are you actually thinking how this would look to a feminist who's black? Are you thinking about how this might feel to someone who's disabled? And I really liked that idea. But somehow that's not at all how the word has come to mean.
No, I mean, it really could be valuable. I think Patricia Hill Collins, who sort of developed the concept of intersectionality along with Kimberlé Crenshaw, she points out that in the US, there are very, very different stereotypes for black women than there were for black men or white women. So a black woman could be discriminated against in an employment position because there was this stereotype that she would be aggressive, sexually promiscuous, all these other things which aren't considered to be traits of white women. So there, you know, that was a valid point. You can't really say, well, this company employs white women, so there's no sexism, and it employs black men, so there's no racism, if there is a prejudice specifically against black women. So that needs to be in there. But unfortunately, right from the start, Kimberlé Crenshaw was critical of liberalism. She said it wasn't the way to go. She said that taking social significance out of categories, it sort of disempowers people. We need to have a less universal group orientated approach. And she wanted to go with postmodernism, which is all about social constructs. And that really kind of shot itself in the foot, because now everything is interpretive, everything is theoretical first, and then trying to make things fit it. And then you get people in opposition and in conflict and in competition with each other, until you're ending up with this really combative approach at looking at what could be a useful theory of understanding how different kinds of identity can compound each other.
Yeah, and also you have to say then, if you want to take this identity first approach, you have to say that, say, a black woman who doesn't agree with you is somehow got a false consciousness, or she's wrong, or she's theorised it wrong, because you know what the black woman or whatever position actually is. So you end up with somebody like Robin DiAngelo telling people what they should think, really.
Yes, I mean, this is something I've been wanting to write about recently. I've just started reading a lot of black conservatives, again, in an American context, because I want to see, you know, a range of how people are addressing racism. And so I've been reading Shelby Steele, and I think his attitude, he really has got this kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps attitude, this really typically conservative personal responsibility thing. And I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, I think this for an individual is probably a really, really good attitude, but it's no good for a social policy. You know, you conservatism isn't a black conservatism is the same as other kinds of conservatism. It focuses too much on the individual's power and not enough on the responsibility of society. So I think we do need to keep pointing out to people who say, well, this is, listen to black people, listen to people of colour, that this is not a monolithic entity. We have a number of black intellectuals and they are to be found all over the political spectrum. What would really be helpful is if people try to look at the good and bad points of all of them. And I think Cornel West does this quite well. I really liked reading his Race Matters, because he's one of his sentences started, "My fellow Christian and friend, Glenn Lowry." And then he went through about how he's completely wrong about everything. And I thought, yes, this is what we need. We need this kind of attitude.
Do you think it's fair or unfair to say that postmodernism is a new religion? Is that an apt characterization?
Well, we did a talk on that and we said no, but it does, I think, fulfill the same social and psychological needs as religion. I think for purposes of the amount of power it can be allowed to have on over how other people think and speak, it should be treated as equivalent to a religion, in that it should be protected. People can believe it, they can say so, they can live by it, but they mustn't impose it on other people.
Right, right. I find the whole thing extremely pessimistic, because it's got a lot of things built into it that make it very hard to course correct. So, for example, this thing of double binds, or this thing that, if you criticise it, you're just proving that you're a very bad person. So it seems to be something that's going to go and go and go and then crash. And I find it hard to be optimistic. You, I think, are a bit more optimistic than me, or at least you were pretending to be in your last chapter. You went through and you said what was worth keeping and what wasn't. Honestly, are you optimistic?
I'm not as optimistic as I was a year ago when I finished writing that chapter, before we saw all the protests that we're seeing now. I still don't think this can last for long, because it is too counterintuitive, and it's really sort of setting itself up against the majority, which that's what worries me particularly. I think we could actually see a pushback in the form of white identity politics and socially conservative ideas about sex and gender, and that this could actually set us back considerably with the amount of progress that we've already made towards racial and gender equality. But I am optimistic, because I don't think this is a set of ideas that can survive for long term. And the more extreme it gets, I think the more liberal lefties who aren't completely committed to social justice ideas are having to admit that there is a problem there, and are having to sort of distance themselves from it. So I've seen the rise of a group that is sort of between me and the social justice people. So they are now criticizing me. They're saying that I'm too dismissive of social justice, but they're also picking out the problems in social justice. So I don't think that little tribe really existed even a couple of years ago. So this is something in the leftist academic sphere which is already starting to distance itself in a way that it hadn't before. So yeah, I think it will happen. I think it will gradually get marginalized unless there's, something dramatic happens first. And I'm afraid that in America, we could even see something equivalent to a civil war at the moment. It's escalating so fast. It's really quite worrying.
OK, I don't want to end on such a pessimistic note. So I want to ask you if you could pick the things from these cynical theories, because quite often, you're a very generous interlocutor. You often say, I really like this idea, or I get something from this, or I think there was a really good insight here. Could you pick, say, three things that you think, you learnt and that you'd like to rescue from the conflagration, if there is a conflagration?
So I think in queer theory, the pointing out that the way we see sexuality has changed so much in the last century, and we shouldn't be too confident that we're now getting it right. That is something I could certainly agree with. Within critical race theory, that's a little bit more tricky, because it's so dogmatic at the moment, and it's gone down the path of Robin DiAngelo. However, I think that we need to point out that there are still some very good scholars looking at racial issues who are still accepted within that sphere. Like I particularly like, as I've said, Michelle Alexander, and she is still well regarded by the majority of critical race theorists. So I think there's space for some improvement there. And then when we come to disability and fat studies, there's some good work in there where we're trying to sort of move the responsibility to be, with disabled people, to be fully active in society from the disabled individual to society, to make society more accommodating of disabled people. When it comes to obesity, to not consider people's worth in terms of their weight to such an extent. That actually is a stigma which isn't helpful. So we can, I think, support those ideas. Unfortunately, there's then a lot of nonsense about how, being healthy is a social construct, but there are good intentions in there. And I think if you've got shared goals but different methods, that's something you can work with.
Well, that's a nice place to stop. Thank you so much, Helen. That was a great discussion. I really enjoyed it. I'm Helen Joyce, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks, Helen.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligent Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligentsquared.com/partnerships.